Okay. Gosh. This is going back about 4 years ago, so it's a little while now, but it's still actually quite fresh. I just, you know, delivered my baby. I was 39 at the time, so, you know, a bit on the older end of the spectrum for giving birth for the first time. And she was a very large baby. She was about 95th percentile for body weight, 99th percentile for head circumference. So. Ooh. Big baby, exactly. Anyway, the midwife suggested that I go in to have a shower and clean up, and she led me in and turned the water on. As soon as the water touched my skin, just out it came. And I thought, my first thought was, oh, my God, did I get her shoes? Oh, I'm so sorry. You know, I didn't mean to get her shoes. And just this overwhelming sense of shame and embarrassment. But, I mean, you know, there's so much – I suppose so much happens in the delivery ward, and there's so much dignity lost, I suppose you could say, that I thought, well, you know, this is probably just part of the whole thing. But then it sort of it kept happening, and I realized I wasn't aware at the time that that was something that can happen as a result of childbirth, but the muscles and the nerves can stretch when you give a vaginal delivery, and you can lose a lot of sensation. So I didn't really have much sensation around needing to go to the toilet. I wasn't sure when I needed to go, and then I'd sort of get up from the bed to go and it would just come out. So it was actually really quite confronting. You're dealing with a new baby, so many different life changes, and that on top of it. I was prepared for the baby. I'd done lots of sort of, you know, research about that. I'd heard so much from different professionals, but I just was not prepared for what was going to happen to my body, and it was really, really difficult, and that was ongoing for a long time.
It's such an emotionally confronting thing too, isn't it? Quite apart from all the practicalities and considerations about, you know, how to mop up and how to leave the house in a safe and comfortable manner. How did you deal with all those different things?
Your point about leaving the house is a really important one, I think. It's actually quite debilitating and very difficult. It was very difficult in the early months and sort of even the first year to leave the house and just sort of and to function and to be able to trust my body to do things like go to the supermarket or take my daughter out. Sometimes I'd sort of, we're on a third floor apartment, and by the time I'd get my daughter out and be out in the driveway, I would have to go back home. I wouldn't be able to make it any further. So, yeah, how did I deal with it? Not very well. There were some days when I just would stay under the doona and not really want to come out. It was very difficult, but physiotherapy was something that I found out about through my GP, and that ended up helping me a lot. Yeah.
So because you had a few different interactions with the medical profession at various points, it's great that you went to your GP. A lot of people don't, apparently. 70% of people who suffer from this just never talk to anyone about it. What was the pathway for you? Was it a straightforward one through GP to physio to success?
It wasn't straightforward. And look, I think it'd be very rare to have a conversation with someone who has had like a really straightforward pathway like that. To be honest, in my opinion, I ended up going to the GP. I did see a physiotherapist on the natal ward when I was in hospital, and she helped me a little bit, but I hadn't, because I was having so many difficulties leaving the house as well, I wasn't really able to go and get help, and I didn't know where any physiotherapists were. I didn't know that I could access them outside of the hospital. It was only because I had to go to my GP for a pap smear of all things after a couple of months, I think it was, and she said, oh, you need to go and see about this, and you should go and see a physiotherapist. Here's someone that you can go and see. So that was really helpful. But up until that point, I hadn't really known how to deal with it. I hadn't really known sort of how widespread the problem was. There's this whole secret branch of the medical sector devoted to pelvic floor care and rehabilitating pelvic floor that I'd had no idea about beforehand. And I guess one of the things that really stunned me was that some of the midwives that I'd spoken to sort of on the ward and then, you know, afterwards when I went back to my obstetrician for the 6 weeks to check up whatever, they were all saying, oh, yes, it's normal to have some incontinence after birth, blah, blah, blah. If it's so normal, why did I not know about it? You know, I had very, what I thought were sort of quite frank and constructive discussions with the healthcare providers who were looking after me up until that point. But it just had never come out. And I'd been told about, there are risk factors like, you know, being a bit older, which I was, body mass index, you're told to sort of keep your weight down, you're told to exercise. But, you know, I was never really told you need to do this because, you know, the risk of incontinence increases. It just sounds like general life advice. You're always told to eat well and exercise. So, you know, if I'd had any idea that, you know, that how high the stakes were, I think I probably would have treated it much differently because there were lots of things to concentrate on at the time, you know. So, okay, general life advice, I'll just sort of put that at the back of my mind. I'm generally mindful of that anyway.
Yeah. Mm. Well, and I understand you had a conversation at one point with a specialist about whether you wanted more children. I mean, that's a big life decision too, to add this information into.
Yes, it's a very big life decision. And, you know, there are so many different factors, obviously, that go into that. So I had conversations with a number of specialists. I saw some urogynecologists. And
I had never heard of a urogynecologist.
Yes. Wow. Nor had I. This is just part of that secret branch of the medical sector that I was talking about before.
They have a special badge.
Yes, very much so, for the initiated only, it seems. But I saw two to try and work out sort of what the source of my problems were, my incontinence problems were, and I wasn't actually able to get a clear answer. Fortunately, I didn't have avulsion, which is where the pelvic floor muscles tear away from the bone. So I was very, very lucky not to have that. I did push out a catheter with the balloon still inflated during delivery, which seemed like it might have caused some injuries, but even with the 3D scans that they had, they couldn't tell me. So all they could say was, you know, you've got these problems. There's nothing that really stands out as being the main driver. You do have pelvic organ prolapse. You can have another child if you want to fix it. Just come back after you've finished your family and we'll deal with what's left, basically. Wow. Which was, you know, I found that quite confronting, but also I guess I wanted to keep in perspective as well, you know, the scope of, I guess, the urogynecologist's remit and thinking about, so when you're pregnant, you're under the care of an obstetrician and then the obstetrician looks after you until you deliver, then there's a six-week check and, you know, you're out of there.
Yep.
And then with the urogynecologist, you know, you're examined. If you require surgery, they'll do that for you. You heal and you're out of there. But physiotherapists were a really great sounding board, and I saw several of them.
Thank you so much for joining us, Alicia O'Reilly, who's a parent and a journal editor, giving us an insight into what it's like to have this experience a lot younger than some people might assume that you would, but it does affect people across age groups. One of the physiotherapists that Alicia was talking about is Dr. Jo Milios. She's a clinical and research physiotherapist based in Perth, and she's an adjunct research fellow at the University of Western Australia. Jo, welcome.
Oh, thank you so much. It's lovely to be joining the conversation today.
We heard a little bit about these statistics. 1 in 10 men, upwards of 1 in 3 women are going to suffer from incontinence at some point. What are some of the causes?
Well, they're really varied, actually. So Alicia just mentioned, you know, being overweight, and that is actually a bit of a problem across all sexes these days, and including younger people. So we know that anyone with a BMI greater than 25 is at risk of developing incontinence issues, and these can be both bladder and fecal. But certainly rising age is an issue. Then we have a whole range of problems sort of relating to, say, the bowel, where people might have constant straining from constipation, or they might have had a neurological disorder like Parkinson's disease or multiple sclerosis, which means that they don't actually have normal functioning of the nerve and central nervous system that controls this. And then, of course, there's pregnancy. And then for men, it's often associated with prostate surgery and things like prostate cancer where men have removal of their prostate and an operation called radical prostatectomy, which leaves them incontinent. And then we've got a whole range of other lifestyle things, like for younger men, it might be lifting heavy weights in the gym or in their workplace, just doing lots and lots of overloading of their abdominal area and pelvic floor. So it can affect, you know, the whole lifespan and across many different disorders.
And I was reading that a lot of men don't really know that they have a pelvic floor. How different is the process for a physio helping a man versus a woman to regain some control, Jo?
Well, first of all, as you said, most men don't even know they have a pelvic floor when they first come to see someone like me. So it's really that point of education that needs to start, that familiarisation process. For most women, because they've actually had that cycle of menstruation from a very early age and then potentially pregnancies and childbirth, they're not more familiar with having a pelvic floor because they're often having issues down there. We'll even talk to girlfriends about things a bit more openly. When it comes to actually training, it is actually quite different because men tend to want to do things with quite a lot of gusto and strength, and the concept of doing something gently in a muscle they can't see is often quite bewildering to them. So fortunately we have things like real-time ultrasound, which is a probe that we place either on the abdominal area or the perineum between the legs for men and females, so we can actually show them the structures and identify exactly what to do. So for pelvic floor training for men, we tend to ask, or women as well, the first step would be to identify what it is to stop and start the flow of urine, and then to maybe try this once a week or so during a urination, so they get an idea of the urethral sphincter. Then we have something called the rectal sphincter, which controls the bowel motion. So that's basically trying to stop wind, and that can be just a gentle squeezing process. But then we have a whole lot of structures in between there that lift up the perineum. So the conversation and the cues that we use for men and women are quite different, but the overall structure is very similar.
And I imagine the conversations would vary widely too, based on people's awareness of their bodies and cultural and social considerations around whether it's deemed appropriate to talk and think about these issues. Jo Milios, physio sounds like it can help a lot of people. Realistically though, are there always going to be some people that it's not going to work for? They're going to have to look at other options like surgery?
Yeah, absolutely. And although physiotherapy is pretty much the first line approach to continence issues, we do know that, you know, there's a percentage that just won't have a response that will give them normal function. So there's surgical options. We have, for both men and women, slings, which involve lifting up the area through mesh. For men, we have something called the artificial urinary sphincter, which is a whole gadget inserted into the pelvis and a little button gauge pressed by the individual that's placed in his scrotum to enter his bladder. And then we have pessaries, which is a silicon type ring that can be placed in the female to help that pelvic organ prolapse that Alicia was mentioning. And we do have a whole range of surgeries, but ideally we're hoping that at least 95% of patients don't actually need to go to that surgical route. But depending on the level of trauma or time out from various surgeries, such as prostate cancer surgery, we don't like to leave people hanging on with these very devastating, potentially quality of life impacts. And not being able to leave the home is, you know, a basic human right. And it's quite tough and quite debilitating and depressing and very isolating to have to deal with this very personal issue,
yes,
unseen
indeed
to anyone else.
Well, and the mesh issue that you mentioned, some people might have concerns about that based on news stories they've seen in recent years. How safe is it?
Well, yes, there has been, you know, some class action around this. And speaking to the urogynecologists here in Perth, we do know that nowadays they have to be very cautious and very selective with who they choose. But it's still a very safe procedure. And it is an option that still has a requirement for some people. And I, you know, every day of the week we have very successful outcomes. It's just something that unfortunately has had a lot of negative press as well, because of, you know, certain brands of mesh eroding over time. But as with all things, we don't want to cause harm to people in medicine. So there's certainly lots of research investigation trying to improve this. But speaking to a really experienced and qualified doctor and surgeon is always the best outcome. And then you can gain the experience of that particular individual. And it's really worthwhile to get second opinions if you're unsure about where to go. But, you know, generally we know there are patients that will need to have mesh. And although, you know, these other measures might be trialled, such as the pessaries, we still have a certain component of patients that will need surgical intervention.
We're speaking with Dr. Jo Milios, who's a clinical and research physiotherapist. And as we heard from Alicia Riley earlier, it often starts with a really good GP that you trust. You can start having those conversations about where you might head for support. Alan White joins us now. He has experienced incontinence firsthand, and we're talking about this because it's something that doesn't get talked about very often, and that can have such huge impacts on people. Alan had prostate cancer treatment. Alan, thanks so much for taking the time to join us today.
Oh, thanks, Hilary, for inviting me. Good to be here.
No, it's a pleasure. And it's great to get the male perspective too, Alan, because I understand that after you had the surgery for your prostate cancer and you had two rounds, you went through a period of urinary incontinence. What was it like living with that day to day?
Interesting.
Interesting times.
I think the first thing I discovered after the catheter came out, which was a wonderful feeling after about 10 days, and I had lovely pull-ups, so I felt like an 18-month-year-old walking around with pull-ups on. And my wife and I went off to celebrate that and have a coffee and a quick shop. And as I got up, I went, geez, I'm feeling a bit heavy in the groin area. My pad was totally full and a lovely wet spot on my lightly coloured pants. So I took it in, no light coloured pants and no sensation of leaking. So I was leaking like the Yarra River for a number of months until that the pelvic floor muscle exercises started to kick in. But yeah, you don't feel you're even leaking, which is a really weird sensation to start with.
And Alan, you're making the best of it now in true, you know, Aussie fashion, but you it must have been pretty tricky for you at the time, just coming to terms with the, not having that control.
Yes, look, this doesn't tend to do men's heads in, most men anyway. And yet, I will say to some men, and Joe will probably confirm this, will be actually continent within 6 weeks of the operation, and there's no real rhyme or reason for that, and others just have to, you know, bear with it and do our exercise and wear the pads, and moving from the pull-ups to the pads inserts in the jocks makes a big difference. But I will say probably around May of 2011 there were days where I just seemed to be going up and downstairs to the toilet or leaking, and I remember actually sitting on the toilet crying because I was totally over this incontinence, less lack of control. I knew what I had to do to be intimate with my wife, medication and injections, but this business of not being able to control the urine flow was, it didn't really get to me. And I went back to the continence physio to keep checking on my exercises, and they would change them to make sure I was doing it differently. But what I found out was that even though I could pull up and do activate the pelvic floor, I wasn't relaxing quick enough. So by the end of the day, my poor old pelvic floor was still in a state of semi-contraction, and went, well, that's enough, I've had enough of this, and just relax, and then I'd leak a bit more. So I had to learn to let go rather than just hang on too tight.
Yeah, I had a physio tell me the same thing, Alan. It does start to feel a bit personal, doesn't it? You're very good at clenching. You need to let go.
Oh.
And yeah. Alan, I understand that you've the physio has really, really helped you to make progress in gaining control again, but there are still some days where you might need a continence aid. What do you think about the resources that exist for men, particularly when we look at shared public toilets? Is enough there?
Look, no, there's not. And if I can just talk about a little story that about two, three months after my operation, I went off to the air show at Avalon, and I was still wearing some heavy number three pads. And luckily, the trailers were in a big semi. So I'm trying to get it off inside this very net small toilet. And luckily, there were bins there. Otherwise, I would have walked out with a very wet pad and no bins. But most public facilities, I notice now the more modern ones, don't have any bins. So if a man walks out with a pad, he's got nowhere to put it. And an example of that would be the Flinders Street Station, the main entrance. It's the electric hand dryers, but there's no bins. Yet downstairs underneath the concourse, there's just a rubbish bin that's not appropriate to be throwing sanitary pads in them. So there's a big push by the Countless Foundations for their Bins for Blokes campaign, which is fantastic, to have sanitary a bin in all toilets, but particularly for public toilets for men and for boys to utilise, so they can get rid of that pad when they walk out. They don't walk out feeling embarrassed and go, oh, now I've got this pad on my hand, or where do I put it in my plastic bag? So that's a huge one that's been pushed around Australia. And as Joe knows, the Wacker ground in Perth has come on board with it, making sure the bins are in that ground. So we're reaching out to all large organisations, all the local councils around Australia, because the different areas are fairly heavy with tourist areas, such as the Surf Coast down here in Victoria, to have these bins in all the public toilets.
Yes, indeed. I know those bins at the main railway stations, they're often just with clear plastic liners now. That's no good. Alan White, thank you so much for chatting to us today. We really appreciate you sharing your story with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We've heard today from Alicia Riley and Alan White, who've experienced incontinence and been really lovely about sharing their experiences with us, and Dr. Joe Milios as well, clinical and research physiotherapist. Let's chat now to Anne Hudson. She's Health Promotion Manager with the Continence Foundation in our last few minutes with this topic on Life Matters. Anne, welcome. Thanks for popping in.
Thanks very much, Hilary.
Now, we've had a question via text about using physios, which do sound like a great way for a lot of people, not all, but a lot of people to regain some control. Are they expensive? Can you get one for less than $200 a session, says our texter? Shouldn't it come off Medicare? What's your response to that?
Well, look, Hilary, in terms of, for physios, it's their first point of call for people would be for them to, talk to their GP and look at what some support they can get. And as, Joe had said, physios are often that first line of support. In terms of Medicare and what is available for people with incontinence and the other support, our nurse continence specialists on our helpline can give advice on that on 1-800-330-0066, because they'll look at each individual case, they'll look at the situation the person is in, and they would be able to give some specialised information and support to people. So if anyone needs any advice in relation to having any sort of financial help or where to go, our nurse continence specialists can give them some specialised personal advice on that.
And we'll give that number again in a moment for
Great.
The Continence Foundation helpline. And with some chronic conditions, you can get a care plan through your GP that gives you some Medicare subsidies towards sessions. Is that the same for a physio that specialises in incontinence?
Again, yes, physios are there with care plans. You can get the care plan for a physio. But again, it all depends on everybody's situation is different. And it depends on that individual person and what's causing the incontinence. And so the best thing to do, again, is getting that medical, that specialist advice from the nurse continence specialist, because they will be able to ascertain what level of support they can get depending on their condition, what's causing the incontinence. Everybody's incontinence is very different. People are individuals, and that's why getting that individual specialist support and help is really important. So, as again, that helpline can ascertain that first protocol, what the person can do for their situation.
And I'm interested, when people do get in touch with you, whether it's via the helpline or any other way, how aware are they of their options? I've noticed a lot of advertising in recent years for continence aids like pads. I don't think I've ever seen an ad for a specialist continence physio. Are people aware that there are other options than just mopping up the damage later?
Look, you'd be surprised. Not everybody is, and that's why, the foundation, we're really trying to get out there, with awareness and advocacy campaigns for both men and women, supporting everyone, because people are just not aware of their options. And it is something, as you know, that's just not talked about, and it's not really a sexy topic for people to pick up and discuss. So that's why things like our Bins for Blokes campaign, although we're targeting men, what it's also doing is getting awareness out there and trying to destigmatize the, you know, the perceptions around incontinence and get everybody talking about it and really realizing there is actually help out there and where can we go to for help. So, you know, I know, you know, with I've had personal situations with family members where I, before I started at the Continence Foundation, I wasn't actually aware of all the supports that I had and found out about the Continence Helpline, and they actually gave me and looked at the options. But again, it's getting people out there talking about it, promoting it, right through from councils to community organisations to doctors' surgeries, saying there is help out there. This is common. I mean, 1 in 4 Australians experience incontinence, over 5 million people. That's a lot of people.
Indeed.
So, yeah, we need to get out to them.
And we're so pleased to be able to be part of that conversation today. Anne Hudson, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Anne's the Health Promotions Manager with the Continence Foundation of Australia, and their helpline that you heard Anne mention before, where you can speak to a nurse continence specialist, is 1-800-330-066, 1-800-330-066. We heard too from Dr. Jo Milios, Clinical and Research Physio and Adjunct Research Fellow at the University of Western Australia, and Alan White and Alicia O'Reilly shared their stories with us too.